Okay, we'll try again. Good morning, James. This is Dave. I'm up here at the Civic Center Ballroom in the press briefing area. Tom Suglieri from Exxon has just come in. None of the heavy hitters, Frank Arassi or Don Cornette, are on scene yet. We're expecting them any time. This will be the first briefing by Exxon since before the day the vessel was floated. That would have been since Tuesday. This also is the first Exxon conference up in the Civic Center since the disruptions of Friday a week ago. There is still a requirement that the press credentials be offered to get in, and there is some control over who all is present. But it is a more free environment than we have experienced the last couple. I guess everyone assuming that information is the goal here. Again, the press conference, the first since the Exxon Valdez was floated off of Bly Reef, the first by Exxon, and we expect it to be underway in just a few minutes. I see Don Cornette and Frank Arassi are here. Members of their staff are still putting up some graphics and charts, I suppose, showing the latest movement of vessels and resources moving around Prince William Sound. This morning there was a briefing to some members of the press by DEC. We weren't able to broadcast that. It was a small group over in the near the DEC offices in the court building. We haven't had a chance to thoroughly be briefed or debriefed as it would be by our reporters who were there. We understand primarily a lot of the action was taken up with reactions to President Bush's announcement this morning that there would be some increased federal participation, although not federalization, of the spill cleanup effort. Hopefully we'll have a more thorough report on that today at 12 o'clock, at least on local news, and throughout the day we'll be up, our member stations along the line will be updating. This press conference about to get underway by Exxon at the Valdez Civic Center Ballroom this press conference is being broadcast via KCHE Radio and through the services of Alaskom and the Alaska Public Radio Network to stations around the state. Still quite a bit of hurly-burly up at the front of the room as cameras and graphics and diagrams and charts and microphones are being adjusted. We assume we'll be starting up in just a minute. For those stations down the line, stand by. We'll be with you as soon as the action starts. But for the moment, this is Dave Hammack at the Civic Center in Valdez, Alaska, giving it back to James Winchester at the KCHU studios. This is Dave Hammack at the Valdez Civic Center Auditorium. Don Cornette of Exxon, the Alaska Operations Manager for Exxon, is about to begin this press briefing. This is the first since Tuesday put on by Exxon, the first since the Exxon Valdez was successfully floated off Bly Island Reef and moved to Outside Bay on the southwest side of Naked Island. Also, this is the first briefing since President Bush's announcement this morning allocating additional federal resources to the cleanup. And since the last Exxon conference, there has been quite a bit of a criticism leveled at Exxon by members of the press and also by the Congress. Here is Don Cornette of Exxon USA.
I'll take a microphone for Mr. Arassi while I'm going through my little bit. First of all, I want to apologize about yesterday. I know you were anxious to talk to Exxon, and as you can see, a lot of things were going on, and we're going to make every effort to communicate with you when we have something that we can say, but I apologize for that. Again, let me remind you that it's very helpful to the people in the radio audience. People all over Alaska listen to these press conferences. It would be very helpful if you would, when you ask a question, identify yourself and your affiliation. And then I need to describe a little shift that we've had in the spokesmanship on this project. As you know, from the time it happened, I have tried to talk to you about everything that I knew about or felt was appropriate to talk about. And from this point forward, I'm going to concentrate on what's happening on the cleanup of the spill and getting the ship out of Prince William Sound. And at this point, the spokesmanship, or earlier than this point, the spokesmanship on those issues surrounding what happened and why and was the response fast enough, that has shifted to the chairman of the board of Exxon, and he is actively discussing those issues. So I will not be able to talk to you about those things, but we have a lot to talk about, and I think if you sense, like I do, that the people in the country really are wondering what's going on in Prince William Sound, I think it would be positive for us to get as much of that information out as we possibly can. That's what I will be trying to do. I may have told some of you that we had authorized construction of a sea otter facility for the city of Cordova. We have now been asked by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service not to do that, but to construct a large mammal recovery center in Seward and a bird recovery center in Seward. And the Alice Berkner I can't speak for Dr. Randall Davis, but Alice Berkner has indicated to me that she thinks that the major impact will, as far as birds go, will be around Seward. And so we're trying to get that effort underway this morning. And Suzanne Stolpe is here with me, and she will come up in a minute and give you her regular report on the birds and the mammals. For those of you who might have slept a little late this morning, the president did make an announcement at a press conference, and I don't have the Q's and A's, but I do have the announcement that was handed out ahead of time, and my secretary will make it available to you over here if that would be helpful to you. I have also this morning signed a letter to the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute and a letter to the Alaska Tourism Bureau, I think it's called, indicating to them that we too are very concerned about the impacts or the potential impacts on tourism and seafood marketing in Alaska, and have offered our help in trying to get the message out that needs to get out to the people around the world about the wholesomeness and the continued wholesomeness of Alaska seafood. Whatever they will put a program together, and we will help them fund it. We also have our claims offices up and running. We are having some traffic, not as much as we expected, but we're asking people who are visiting the claims office to let us know if that is working satisfactorily, and we will be staying on top of that, because as a result of the closing of the herring fishery, we expect some large number of claims, and we are trying to get in the best position to handle those as promptly as we can. We have also visited in the last 2 days with the cities of Seward, Homer, Kodiak, Kenai, Whittier, and we've had representatives in Cordova for several days now. Now, if we could, I would like to ask Suzanne Stolpe to come up and tell you what's happening with the birds and the mammals.
Well, the center is a very busy one today. Let me give you some numbers first, and then I'll kind of give you an update on what's happening with movement of otters. As of this morning, we had 166 birds received at the center. Of those, 4 have been released. That was last Sunday, and my understanding is that there will be a release today of one or more birds, approximately sometime around 1 o'clock, and I will have further word of that in the next couple of hours once they've evaluated all the birds that could possibly be released for to make sure that they're okay. Of the birds that have been received, 60 have expired. In the otter department, we have received to date 85 otters. Excuse me. Of those, 42 have expired. Of the otters that are in San Diego, 3 have 3 are still alive. 2 have expired to date. The Otter Center is the new Otter Center at Groudon Harrison Elementary School is now up and running, and just about now all of the otters will have been moved over there and settled in. There will be a press tour of the facility at 4 o'clock today. Dr. Davis will be available then to answer your questions about the center and other related matters. And I think that's it. Any questions?
Yeah, a couple of questions. Do you know how many dead birds have been picked up, and what's the rationale for moving the center to Seward? Why do people think the impact will be in that area?
Boy, I cannot answer the second question, nor the first one, actually. U.S. Fish and Wildlife has been collecting the birds that that are received here dead, and they would have a number for you.
What is the capacity of the elementary school facility?
It will hold 96 otters compared to the 30, excuse me, the capacity for 30 that exists right now.
If the 28 boats that are now mobilized were to all be collecting live otters, as they are now forbidden to do, how quickly do you think your facilities would max out?
No telling. We don't know how many otters are out there until we receive them. We got 15 in yesterday, and we're able to handle them in the smaller facility, so I can confidently say that we could handle more than that in the larger facility. We'll have gone from 3 cleaning stations to 10 cleaning stations, and then we'll have capacity for significantly more otters once they've been cleaned and looked at, stabilized.
How much capacity is being looked at installing in Seward? Do you know that?
Steve, I'm sorry. Could you identify yourself for the radio?
Steve Heimel, Alaska Public Radio Network.
Okay. And the question again, please.
How many otters will the Seward facility be able to handle, and when will it be in operation, and who will build it?
I know that Exxon will be funding that project. Maybe Don can talk about that. I don't have the word on that yet.
I just talked to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they're going to go down and try to locate some facility that could be converted, and I don't know exactly who will do it, but we'll be guided by them on that.
There is a capacity problem that I'm trying to get at here. If the 28 boats were collecting, they could bring in hundreds of otters. It would be a little harder to get them to Seward than it would be to get them here. If they end up being allowed to do that, I'm concerned as to how they would be dealt with.
Well, I don't want to speak for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but I will repeat what they said to me, and that is that they would prefer to do a good job with a smaller number of otters than a poor job with all the otters they can bring in. And it is true that they have asked the boats with people that they feel are not trained to handle these mammals, and also there's a safety risk. They've asked those people not to do that. And they want the facility in Seward because they feel that the larger otter population is over there and the oil is going in that direction and that that's where the impact is going to be. But they're studying all that right now, and we'll get back to us and we'll help them do what they say needs to be done.
Suzanne, Gary Shepherd from ABC News. Will the arrival of federal troops here in any way help your efforts to save the mammals or the birds, or will they be used that way?
I asked Dr. Davis that just before we came, and his understanding is that Fish and Wildlife Service will be coordinating that effort. It's possible that they will be participating, but I don't think they know that yet even.
What would they do if you use Army troops?
I don't know.
Suzanne, J. Matthews, Washington Post. Can you or Don clear up this statement made this morning that Fish and Wildlife barred a plan to move some otters to British Columbia and then formed a compromise in which they would allow some otters to go to British Columbia if you didn't get a new otter center set up by one today?
My understanding of the situation is that arrangements were made to ship 6 to 8 otters to Vancouver Aquarium yesterday. Fish and Wildlife Service decided not to issue permits to the Vancouver Aquarium to receive the otters, and my understanding is that issue is yet to be resolved today.
Do you know why, what their motive was?
Not.
I do not.
Don, you have any thoughts on that?
The gentleman I spoke to this morning was Walter Stieglitz, and it is strictly, as I understand it from him, a concern for the well-being of the otters.
That they couldn't survive the trip?
That the trip would be stressful to them, and they are still evaluating whether they want to ship otters out of the state.
Where is Mr. Stieglitz, or a spokesman for them, and how do we reach them?
I believe that Mr. Stieglitz's office is in Anchorage. I'm not sure. I spoke with him on the phone. He does have local people in the area.
Do you know where they're hanging out?
One is at the DEC, and one is at the Coast Guard.
Thank you.
They told me.
Benny van der Baan, Dutch Radio. Did you get more offers to help the sea otters or the birds to clean or something like that from Europe, for example?
We've received offers of volunteer help from around all over the world, from Europe as well as the United States. At this point, there are over 400 volunteers who are helping with the effort, most of whom are local folks, and we have plenty of folks to help out right now.
But I mean from professional organizations?
Mm. I have not heard of any.
Zoos or like that? No
offers. Nothing that I've heard of.
How long will it be before we know the results of the work of the pathologists that started working yesterday on the otters that have died? The SeaWorld people are saying there was liver damage in the ones that died over there. In other words, it's toxic effects from the oil, and that is a concern. I've talked to them at Wildlife, and that's one of the concerns they have. How soon will we know how big an influence that is in the mortality of the otters in your center?
The pathologists sent tests, their samples to the facilities that they're working with outside of Alaska, excuse me, yesterday, and their expectation is that we won't have any results that they're comfortable reporting until sometime next week, probably midweek.
Meanwhile, do you have access to the SeaWorld data on their pathologist work?
I know that the pathologists here are talking to SeaWorld. I don't know how closely they're working together.
Dr. Davis told me that he had full confidence in the work of those people. I believe he's worked with them before. Can you back that up?
Sure.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now we will have Frank Iarossi, president of Exxon Shipping Company, to give you the update on what's happening on the oil spill cleanup.
Well, excuse me, welcome to day 15 and press conference 18. I recognize a few veteran faces there. I'd like to start by talking about the current location of the oil, both in Prince William Sound and in the Gulf of Alaska. And I'll refer to this map if I can. And this comes from overflights both late yesterday afternoon and early this morning.
The heavy accumulation of oil still in Prince William Sound is in these locations
to the east side of Knight Island. There is shoreline impact along this western side of Knight Island Passage, and also along, in some locations, the eastern side of Knight Island Passage. These passages are now relatively clear of oil, with just some sheen and some spotting of heavy oil in streamers and stringers within the sheen. The northern face of Smith Island is impacted, and the northwestern face of Green Island is also impacted. There is some shoreline impact along the eastern side of Knight Island. We're now, just let me give you the good news story. These four fisheries and hatcheries, which were defined by day three as being very, very critical. These were must-defend locations. All four of them, the defenses, both booming and skimming, are holding. The major part of the skimming operations will be today along the eastern side of Knight Island, attempting to boom and skim in this heavy accumulation along the shoreline in between Knight Island and Green Island.
Okay.
The oil moving offshore. The overflight late yesterday afternoon showed that oil was beginning to move away from the coast, and the threat to Seward and Anchorage areas are lessening. We have an overflight going on right now, and we'll be able to define that for you later today. The Exxon response team has grown to over 125 people. The casualty response team, both the initial response team and the second team that came up, is now being supplemented by a longer-term group, which will be responsible for the shoreline cleanup, the restoration, and also claims handling. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Besides the Exxon personnel, we have some 215 contract experts, advisors, and contract management people, which are augmenting our team out of our new control center. In addition, we have over 400 contract personnel working as offshore crews, shoreline crews working in different phases of the logistics system that we had to build, and also in the animal recovery and other support activities. We have another 250 to 300 contract personnel which are working and manning the 110 vessels which are now in the Exxon Navy. Altogether, we're approaching about 1,000 people under contract to Exxon in various phases of the recovery. As of last night, we had 67 cargo flights arrived in Alaska, and they have brought in 1,750 tons of equipment. That's 3.5 million pounds of response equipment. We have 18 aircraft contracted to us, operating primarily out of the Valdez Airport. We've deployed over 160,000 feet of boom, and we have an additional 120,000 feet en route to Alaska. 30,000 feet of that boom is moving westward to the Seward area, Homer area, and Kodiak. We have a total of 29 skimmers that are either in operation or being deployed from Valdez. We have five others that are being moved westward towards Seward. There's one in Seward, two going to Homer, and two going to Kodiak. So we're beginning to move our resources westward to counter the potential threat from the oil that's in the Gulf of Alaska. We have 32 additional skimmers en route to Alaska, and they'll be deployed to assist in the cleanup operation in Prince William Sound, and also to move further westward if that threat increases. We are continuing to develop a comprehensive communication system to cover Prince William Sound. We're going to need that to coordinate the air observations, the boat crews, and the shoreline crews. We've also are continuing to hold health and safety seminars for our work crews. So far, we've had a very good safety record, and we want to keep that going as we get more people in the field. We have a number of committees, and these are committees that were established about a week ago. And these committees are comprised of members of from Exxon, from the Coast Guard, and from many, many state and federal agencies that are part of the response. And those committees continue to meet and continue to develop plans and guidelines for the cleanup. I understand that the lead committee, that's the Committee on Setting Cleanup Priorities, agreed to a priority list last night, and that's important to us because now we can begin to understand which areas we will be working in first. So that I understand that work has been completed. I have not seen the report of that committee yet. We also had a test demonstration yesterday on Naked Island, and we were testing different cleanup methods, and I understand the general consensus was that pressurized hot water is the most effective shoreline cleanup method considering the environmental sensitivity of the area. Again, I haven't had a full report, but that's a preliminary finding from those tests. Our strategies at this point are to continue to defend those four fisheries. We still have some oil in the water, and there still is a threat to them. So we'll be continuing those defenses. We have a very significant portion, over half of our total resources in Prince William Sound have been allocated to the defense of those four fisheries. And we're very pleased that that was the right priority, and it seems to be effective. We will continue to boom and skim to try to remove that oil that's still in Prince William Sound, particularly along the east side of Night Island.
You're listening to a live broadcast from the Valdez Civic Center. Frank,
as we get new supplies and equipment in, we'll be booming and skimming some of the smaller bays, particularly on both sides of Night Island. but also up around Eleanor Island, because we want to trap the oil that's in those small bays and keep it from moving out into the sound. So we're going to be using the boom that's coming in to trap that oil, to skim it, and then begin the shoreline cleanup in those areas. We'll also be deploying some new resources westward, and we're tracking that slick that's in the Gulf of Alaska very closely. Today we're going to attempt to break up some of that slick that's offshore using two vessels that we have hired and I believe two vessels that the Coast Guard has. We're also fitting a large barge, ocean-going barge, with two of our largest skimming systems, and we'll be moving that into the Gulf of Alaska to attempt to pick up the heavy accumulation that's scattered out there. With regard to the Exxon Valdez, the survey began yesterday. It's still underway. I have not seen the results of that survey yet, but of course we know that there is extensive damage there. But we'll be defining that more closely, first with an external survey using divers, and then secondly, in selected tanks that are the heaviest damaged, we will be putting divers into the tanks, into the seawater that's now in those tanks, and we'll be getting an internal survey. From those surveys, we'll be able to define what emergency repairs we need to make before we can move the vessel. I'll take your questions.
See, your figures, John Blackstone from CBS News, your figures of response team and contract experts, I figure you have 340 people about in that team and 600 to 700 people out working on the water, which tells us that you have one manager for every two workers. With a ratio like that, why do you have to call in the Coast Guard, or why has the Coast Guard been asked to come in to take over the management?
Well, you know, we have a lot of people planning the activities. We have moved from the oil recovery on the tanker at the same time we were doing our salvage work, and at the same time we've been massing logistics. All kinds of equipment, and we have a very extensive logistics system that we've developed to move this equipment in. We have many, many, many contractors working for us, and each of those contractors brings a manager. And now we're in the process where we'll be gearing up the field work. So the ratio will become much different as we get into the actual cleanup phase where we have large numbers of people in the field. But we had to manage that very carefully before we could get there. Yes, sir.
Pardon my ignorance here. I showed up a titch late, so if you could rehash Exxon's feeling about Bush's announcement this morning, its reaction to.
I really don't know any of the details. I can't really respond to it. We'll be learning more through the day.
On that, then. Sure. What jobs do you see that could be undertaken by American troops, by military troops, that cannot be done by Alaskan workers now waiting to be hired by your company?
I really couldn't respond to that. I haven't given a moment's thought. I
think no idea what American troops
do. No, I think Admiral Nelson will have some visitors in today, and he'll be working to define that.
Do you need manpower with all the people you have ready to work for you here? Do you need that kind of manpower?
I really couldn't respond.
Mr. Irossi, Gary Shepard from
yes,
ABC
Gary,
News.
How are you? I think you're a veteran from day one, aren't you?
Matter of fact.
Welcome. I hope you feel better than I do.
How does Exxon feel about the Coast Guard taking over what had been your job, at least the direction of it, and all the criticism in Washington that you've done a lousy job with this cleanup?
Well, you know, there are different opinions depending upon what facts you have. As far as working with the Coast Guard, we have worked very, very closely from the moment we landed. First with the local on-scene commander, and then with Admiral Nelson. And we have developed, you know, we developed about day three or four a steering committee that was comprised of myself, Admiral Nelson, and Dennis Kelso from ADEC. And Admiral Nelson was the chairman of that committee. So going back to, I don't remember whether it was day or three or four, Admiral Nelson was clearly in a leadership position, so I don't see it as a significant change. Now, I think he's going to get a lot more resources, and we'll need to see how that develops.
But Exxon had been directing the cleanup, and now it's the Coast Guard that's giving the orders.
I guess there'll be a shared responsibility. We have to see how that develops. Gary.
Frank, I'm Arthur Lord from NBC News. Yesterday, from maps that were given to us by the Coast Guard, It looks as if the slick is endangering the Kenai Peninsula, in particular the Criswell Rocks at the National Marine Sanctuary. Can you tell us anything about that, and can you tell us what efforts the company is making to save that resource?
There is about 50% of the slick that still remains, and it's is now in the Gulf of Alaska by our data. There was a northwesterly wind during the night, and that moved that slick further offshore, away from the Kenai Peninsula, away from Resurrection Bay. So at least overnight, that threat has been reduced.
We have any cleanup resources there at this time?
We have moved about 15,000 feet of boom into the Seward area. We're moving more boom further down coast into the area around Homer, and then further down to the area of Kodiak. And we have five skimmers either in place or on the way to those three locations. So we are in the process of moving resources westward. We have gotten good advice from the local agencies on the sensitive areas that we need to be aware of as we position resources. And we will, starting today, be attacking the accumulation of oil, and really it's in two forms out there. One is a very, very thin sheen, a micron-type sheen, and then some heavy stringers of oil. And we'll be attacking those heavy stringers in two ways. One, breaking them up, breaking them up with two of our boats and two of the Coast Guard boats, and also putting this big skimmer in operation on an offshore barge. Part of the problem we have out there is there's no wave action. As you know, it's just absolutely beautiful weather. But
follow up, please. When do you expect these resources to arrive on the scene?
Some has already arrived.
Yes. Hi, Rossi. Bill Kaufman from the Boston Globe.
Yes, sir.
I was at Sawmill yesterday, and the people out there tell me there were no Exxon workers at all out there. It was all a local hands-on effort by the fishermen.
That's the way it was designed. We contracted a number of fishing boats. You know, out of this 110 vessels we have, we've got over 30 vessels from the Cordova District Fishermen's Union, plus two large vessels, the Bartlett and the Aurora. And we essentially gave that area to them as their lead area, and we are supplying them all the resources they have asked for. Including, as of last count, there was 65,000 feet of boom around Sawmill. I mean, we got most of the boom in the world around Sawmill. And that's the resources that we have supplied to the fishermen, but, you know, they are the folks that have been primarily involved down there. Yesterday, we went to help put this new 42-inch boom in place, and that's the boom that's now the outer defense. We have five defense rings at Sawmill, and between the Coast Guard and our own supervisors, we position that boom for them.
You answered the plea of a fisherman there. He said Exxon would need to make its commitment for years and years and years and years. Is this the kind of a commitment you're talking about?
I think I have addressed that a number of times in a positive way. Yes. 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 You look like a veteran, too.
I left my shaver in Anchorage. Could you characterize for us the discussions you've had with the Coast Guard over the last 24 hours about how your relationship, your managerial relationship? We're told that you've signed some kind of, or come to some kind of new agreement on how you all will divvy up responsibility. Could you tell us what that agreement does?
Yeah, we had discussions ongoing yesterday morning, and it was really just an evolution of where we have been. I think a lot of that, or some of it, may be subject to change, and I really don't want to comment on it now. It's been sort of put on hold until we see what other resources the Admiral will have. But it was an evolution from where we were going back to about day three.
You signed an agreement with the Coast Guard?
We have not. I don't think we need to sign it. We've had a very good relationship with them. And you know, we've worked on organization charts and boxes and descriptions of who does what. Yes, sir.
You have agreed to change the management structure?
Yes.
Yes.
In what way? Can you tell us, please?
It's just an evolution of where we've been, where we are working together in a very, very cooperative way.
How different today than a week ago, sir? There should be no change.
It's just an evolving process. You know, I think you have to wait for Admiral Nelson to describe his plan once he fully understands what resources he has. I'll leave that to him. Yes, sir.
Mr. Kelso said this morning that under this agreement, the Coast Guard would have the authority to deploy forces on the water. It basically was taking over the on-the-water recovery activity, at least the leadership of it. And he said basically they would be making strategic decisions about where resources would be deployed while you continue to provide the resources. Is that accurate?
They'll be providing, yeah, the Admiral will be providing strategic direction. But all of our contractors still work for us, and we'll need to be managing that.
Well, doesn't that boil down to you not running the show anymore, but the Coast Guard running the show?
No, because we have a coordination team between the Coast Guard and ourselves, which will be interacting on a continual basis in our new larger facilities. The Admiral has an office and some staff, and we interact on a continuous basis.
Must be pretty embarrassing for a company of your size that's been successful all around the world for so long to be in a situation that the Coast Guard has to come in and show you how to manage it.
Oh, I don't
assist
really
you
think,
with at least
really
assist you with
so.
Management,
if
but you're your company.
If you just think about the challenge we had when we arrived here with 1 million barrels in a damaged vessel hanging on a reef and 240,000 barrels in the water, and a 240,000 barrel threat, we were told that our most important objective was to protect four fisheries. What have we accomplished? We got the 1 million barrels out of the way without spilling anymore. We got the ship off the reef, and we're still defending four fisheries. You know, victories in the eyes of the beholder.
Mr. Rossi, it's been 2 weeks now. You've got nearly 1,000 people here, and virtually no oil has been recovered. I think the number is 5%. What have you been doing for 2 weeks if you haven't been picking up oil?
5% of the original oil spill, but don't forget that natural vaporization took care of a very, very significant part of it. I think of the oil remaining on the water, the oil that has been recovered is a very significant portion of it.
But they tell us, the Department of Environmental Conservation says you've gotten virtually no oil back yet.
Yeah, I think there's about 15,000 barrels recovered through skimming.
Out of 1 million barrels, that's next to nothing.
No, wait. The 1 million barrels we took care of, it's in the refineries now. Yes.
15,000 is a very, very minuscule amount, is it not? After 2 whole weeks?
For skimming operations, has been very, very effective. The Coast Guard commander on scene said that this is the most effective skimming operation he's seen. So I think you have to recognize what potentially is possible and what has really transpired. Let me take a question over here.
If I could follow up on that question. Every day, State Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, Dennis Kelso, says that there's a lot of activity out there, but no effective management, no productive results. There have only been 5% of the amount of oil picked up. And I think it's not so much a question of what Exxon's been doing, which you still need to answer, but why hasn't Exxon picked up more than 5% of the oil when in the third week of the oil spill?
All of the equipment we have has been deployed and has been working very effectively from the reports I get, including from the Coast Guard. You know, you need to recognize what is possible and what has been going on. I understand Commissioner Kelso has not been happy. Obviously, he wasn't happy from day one. You know, maybe he'll be happier when he gets a lot of reinforcements here. We'll see how that develops.
What method of reimbursements has been worked out to pay for the federal troops and such?
Hold that question for 1 minute. There are a lot of things that you need to understand. Under our law, the U.S. Coast Guard is always in charge. We have taken direction from them from the beginning. Now, an awful lot of the oil that was spilled, as Frank said, evaporated, and a lot of it dissolved in the water. But as you know, a lot of it is on the shoreline. This is a very difficult task, and it's a very almost impossible task to pick up 150, 200,000 barrels of oil off the water. First of all, there's not that much left. But we're making the best progress that we can make with the equipment that is available anywhere in the world. I'm trying to give you an accurate number of that. But most of the oil, as you can imagine, as it's brushed down the shorelines, has either been deposited on the shore or is trapped close to the shore. But don't forget, you know, if you ask what have we been doing, remember those fish hatcheries, the priorities. We have spent a tremendous amount of time and money and all the boom that we could get to protect those. When we get the oil up is not nearly as important as getting it up in the right way. And believe me, we are giving that a lot of attention, and we're getting a lot of help from the state and from the federal agencies.
And does that tell you something about the lack of preparation before this event, when you had to use, as Mr. Iarossa said, most of the boom in the world
to protect one hatchery, an important hatchery, but one hatchery on one small bay? And Mr. Iarossa said you needed most of the boom in the world to do that.
Well, if you had most of the boom in the world in Valdez and you had this spill in Mexico, what would you do then?
Well,
you'd haul it all down there, and it takes time.
But most of the boom in the world.
When's the last time you moved 3.5 million pounds somewhere in 2 weeks?
But most of the boom in the world has been enough for one bay. Shouldn't there be more boom everywhere, more equipment everywhere in the world?
We are bringing all the equipment here that we can get, and the manufacturers, as I understand, are turning it out as fast as they can.
Both of you gentlemen talk about the fact that you deployed your equipment and you're working the best you can, but the local people and the state people talk about idle equipment that's broken, lack of direction, and your assessment of what's going on?
My assessment of any time you're in a crisis, things go wrong. That's why it's a crisis. But you overcome those things and you move on. We have a concerted effort. It is an enormous effort. And we're giving it all the resources and effort that we can give it.
Don, do you have any estimate of how much oil is still out there on shore in the water after you figure in the vaporization and the evaporation and the other forces that came out?
We have some people working that to try to get a feel for it. The last number I heard was we think maybe 50% or more of the oil has gone out to sea.
Do you share concern that any reduction of federal forces not take job opportunities away from local Alaskans who can help in this cleanup?
I don't think it would be good for Exxon to get in between the president and the governor on that. We have committed to local hire, and we will stay committed to local hire, but we're also going to take the direction that is given us from the agencies that have the legal control over this.
Mr. Cornett, what you said about this being a crisis, well, either one of you, Mr. Iarossa, you don't have to run off, but, about this being a crisis, I've been here for a couple of weeks, and I've been getting the feeling that maybe this is an insurmountable crisis.
No, I think we are very, very far along the recovery process. You know, we're about now to, with the agency's agreement on shoreline priority, and with what I believe or understand to be agreement on the acceptable methods, we can now begin to address shoreline cleanup. And of course, we have to start in the north area because we don't want to clean the beach that's going to be impacted that night. So we're now in the process of starting that final phase of response, which is the shoreline cleanup, and that includes the oil that's still on the water trapped in small bays and inlets. And that's the process we're going to be starting now. And we have a lot of preparations done for it, including the whole communication system, including the safety seminars that we've been giving to all these people, and including the 400 or so that are hired to start this effort.
So when I asked Commissioner Kelso yesterday, have we lost the war, and are we in a defensive sort of mode right now? His answer was in the affirmative. I'll ask you the same thing. Have we lost the war, or are we simply trying to defend little pockets now?
Well, you have to define what the war is when you have 240,000 barrels of oil on the water. You know, our war was to defend four fisheries as our primary objective above everything else. And there is still some threat there, but I think the major threat to the fisheries is over, but we still have to be very, very cautious. Now we have to get into that shoreline cleanup effort, and we have to do it with a lot of sensitivity because shoreline cleanup could be worse than the shoreline impact from the oil. So we've got to do this carefully. We've got to do it by coordinating our efforts and our plans with a lot of different organizations and interest groups, and we have to make sure that the cleanup effort improves the situation and does not have result in more impact. So it's got to be done carefully. We're going to do it from the seaside and not from the land side. That makes it more complex. That's why we're moving in a lot of floating equipment, and all that is going on. It's not like Atlantic City. You could just rush 10,000 people onto the beach with shovels. That's not the problem we're facing.
What will you do with the military forces that come? How would you use them?
That's not my job, really. I'm handling the non-government forces.
You're running the cleanup operations.
In conjunction with Admiral Nelson. He's going to worry about the government
well,
people.
If he offered them to you, what would you do with them?
I think he's trying to figure that out now.
Mr. Ira,
you need to talk to him about that. Yes, ma'am.
Claire Richardson, Alaska Public Radio Network. If we take a look at just a slice of the pie, you're talking about this major a litany of resources here that you have. One of the problems that's being perceived by the state and why they want the Coast Guard to have more control is the problem of out in the field, management out in the field. And one example, which we tried to reach you yesterday, but there was no answer at the Exxon headquarters, was...
there are a lot of folks there, believe
me. No one answered the phone, but one example was given was with your with the Exxon Valdez. You had a skimmer out there near the Battle Sawmill Bay and a barge, a tug and a barge out there working. It was pulled away at 11 o'clock at night to go and assist the Exxon Valdez, leaving men out in the middle of the bay without any work to do, and this caused great...
What now?
Mr. Ira,
you need to talk to him about that. Yes, ma'am.
Claire Richardson, Alaska Public Radio Network. If we take a look at just a slice of the pie, you're talking about this major a litany of resources here that you have. One of the problems that's being perceived by the state and why they want the Coast Guard to have more control is the problem of out in the field, management out in the field. And one example, which we tried to reach you yesterday, but there was no answer at the Exxon headquarters, was...
there are a lot of folks there, believe
me. No one answered the phone, but one example was given was with your with the Exxon Valdez. You had a skimmer out there near the Battle Sawmill Bay and a barge, a tug and a barge out there working. It was pulled away at 11 o'clock at night to go and assist the Exxon Valdez, leaving men out in the middle of the bay without any work to do, and this caused great confusion because one of your priorities, you said, is to skim up that oil before the wind shifts and it could affect the hatchery. Who's giving the orders for
from,
the tugs?
From day one, there has been a continuous shift to priorities. And those priorities are established primarily by the state and by the Coast Guard. The reason the barge was shifted was because it was decided by the Coast Guard in response to state agency requests that they wanted, it wasn't a skimmer that went up, it was a storage barge. They wanted to move the storage barge in the event that there was a large release of oil when the ship was moved. They wanted to be able to skim it and then unload the skimmers into the storage barge. So the decision was made to relocate the storage barge toward the Valdez in case there was a major release. It didn't turn out to be, but it was a precautionary step. And I don't, you know, there's been an awful lot of shifting of priorities, and we've responded as best we can.
Would you say those priorities were shifted and not always the state of the Coast Guard and Exxon were in sync with knowing these shifting priorities?
We haven't really set priorities other than for the lightering and the actual refloating of the vessel. Well, other priorities as far as oil on the water has really come to us from the fishermen's groups, the state agencies, and the Coast Guard, and we've responded to them. We've done a lot of responding.
But you would say there's a lack of communication sometimes between the three?
I don't believe so. We have set up back on about day three or four, it all seems to blend together, but back on about day three or four, we set up what we call an operations coordination group.
That's a very large group, but the last two meetings, night before last, there was 45 people in the committee, and last night I was there, there were 43 people. And these represent all of the agencies, the fishermen's groups, the Coast Guard, Exxon, federal agencies besides state, and they have two meetings a day, in the morning and in the afternoon. The morning meeting, I think, is around 9 o'clock, and the evening meeting is about 8 o'clock. And they go on for sometimes 2 or 3 hours. So there is an awful lot of coordination that goes on in those meetings.
Your personal question.
Personal, yes.
I don't know whether these are the rules in an American press conference. Do you personally feel ashamed what happened?
Absolutely not. Ashamed about the grounding? I'm certainly very concerned and about the grounding, and we need to understand a lot more about it. About the response, absolutely not. We have people here that have been working day and night, averaging 20 hours, working their hearts out to get their hands around the problem. So feel ashamed, absolutely not. You know, we took 1 million barrels off a ship, and we did it flawlessly. We took the ship off the reef, and we've protected 4 hatcheries. They were our absolutely first objective. So I don't feel ashamed at all, sir.
Does this accident change your ideology of your managers in these big multinational companies that money-making is the first priority of the world?
That's not our first priority. And quite frankly, you know, we'll be reassessing a lot of things in light of this.
Okay.
We actually place safety as our first priority.
Mr. Hirose,
yes.
The people involved in the defense of those fisheries, the fishermen and the people from the state agencies, make a rather insistent and perhaps persuasive case that they basically created that defense because they didn't believe that you were responding, particularly in the first instance, and that later they drew resources from you, but they basically have been conducting that activity. Given the fact that you're saying that that is your major emphasis and your major success story, aside from the lightering operation and the salvage, and that you're saying that you have drawn all the available resources in the world, one comes to the conclusion that there are fairly limited resources available for dealing with the major oil spill, both to you and to the oil industry in general, which is represented here in a large way. Did you at any point consider any large-scale action to recover oil off of open water? And has any opportunity for picking up water in pancake slick form when it's all in one place now passed entirely?
No, it hasn't passed. We're still skimming both in Prince William Sound, and we're going to start out in the Gulf of Alaska. You know, we marshaled... We came in here, we already had about 5 or 6 planes in a year before we got ourselves in the air to get here. And we have marshaled 3.5 million pounds of equipment, 1,750 tons. And we have also used every bit of local resource that we had here. You know, we started hiring the fishing boats Saturday night. That was day 2. And by day 3, we had 26 fishing boats hired. And, of course, they have been the people on the water with the boats rigging the boom. But we have been sending them every resource possible, every single thing they have asked for. Jack Lamb and Dennis Kelso and those folks cannot say that there was one single request that they have made to us that we have not responded to the fullest extent we could.
They basically said that they did this thing and that you gave them equipment. I'm talking about your
that's the role. That is exactly the role we laid out when we set the defense. That they would take that role, we would take the logistics and support and the expertise that they needed to do their job. But that they were actually going to do it because they owned the boats. It was their fishery or hatchery that they were protecting. And that's exactly the way it was laid out from the very moment. So I'm not sure what the complaint is. They were the forces in the field, and our job was to support them with logistics, equipment, and everything we could give them. And we have done that. You know, I'm sure that if you ask Jack Lamb and his folks,
they will tell you we have responded to every request, and sometimes when they asked for one, we sent three.
The question is, though, if what then have your forces in the field been doing? If you talk about this operation, yet the amount of oil recovered seems to be rather small.
Look, and the forces in the field, if you look at the skimmers, there's a Coast Guard skimmer out there. There's a number of Navy skimmers. There's a skimmer we brought in from the United Kingdom, a large skimming operation. There's skimmers that we moved up from the U.S. But that all comes with contract labor. I mean, Exxon personnel don't operate skimmers. When we hire our charter a flight to bring in a skimmer, it comes with operators, whether it's Navy operators or Coast Guard operators or civilian under contract to us. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Rossi, Linda Wright from Newsweek magazine. Can you tell me how much has Exxon expended totally so far in the cleanup and rescue effort? How much are you projecting the total cost to be?
We have just begun to count, and I don't have any figures for you.
Estimates at this point. You have an idea of how much equipment you've moved.
It's here. A lot of money, but how much it is, we haven't even begun to consider. It's many millions.
Many millions.
Why are the people out mopping up oil if that's not your priority?
That has been our priority all along. We have a number of priorities, but we really have not been geared up to do the beach cleanup until now. Now we have, I understand, so I'm really speaking on what I think came out of those two committees last night. We have the priority as to which areas need to be cleaned first, and of course you don't clean an area until it's free of oil on large amounts of oil on the water, and we have an accepted method as to how we're going to go about cleaning those different areas. Up to this point we've been using just manual labor in one area, manual labor being absorbent pads and rags to clean up, because that's the tool we had to us.
It wasn't time to do that. It was time to clean up offshore.
Well, you know, it's our priority to get rid of all the oil, but there is a sequence in which you have to do it. And the timing factor on beach cleanup is that you have the major accumulations not continuing to roll into the beach.
Mr. Irossi,
the sequence was decided for us.
Has Exxon, sir, told its employees out there, those people it has hired, that they would be fired for talking to the press?
Absolutely not. We've addressed that a number of times.
Absolutely not.
Thank you. We have another gentleman here that I would like to introduce. Mr. Ulysses LaGrange, the Senior Vice President of Exxon USA, and he has a few words that he would like to say to you.
I came to Alaska the other day to announce the establishment of an operations office here in Valdez. I think many of you may be aware Exxon has not had a major operating presence here in Alaska. Up on North Slope, our partner ARCO is the operator, and of course Alyeska operates our interest in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. But obviously we have a big job ahead of us here in Alaska. We've moved a lot of people here. We'll be keeping a large force of people here in Valdez, and so we're forming an office to handle that for us. And I'd like to introduce the first general manager of that office, Otto Harrison. Otto is coming to us from Sydney, Australia. As you notice when he talks, he's not an Aussie. He's a Texan by birth. For the past several years, though, he has been general manager of the production department of Esso Australia. He has been in charge of all of the operations in Australia, including the offshore production in the Bass Straits. He has a very diverse background, including the offshore production in the Bass Straits. He has a very diverse background in his 30-year career with Exxon. He has served in production management and planning operations in the lower 48. He's been in our Washington office, our corporate headquarters office. He has been a manager in our Libyan operation as well. And so he has what we think is the unique background particularly suited to the job that we have before us, which is a complex offshore logistics problem that we have to face, including many, many interfaces with state and federal governments. And of course, I'm sure those will be escalating somewhat with the President's announcement this morning. Now, Frank Irasi is president of our shipping company. He's been up here in his capacity in charge of the emergency response team. And as you've heard, he had his priorities, safely remove the rest of the oil, get the vessel refloated, and salvage that vessel, and then proceed as rapidly as we could to contain the oil and to clean up the rocks and beaches. That latter one's going to be a very long-term process, and so we need a permanent organization to get that done. But the activities with the ship itself, removing the oil and so forth, have been successful, but they're coming to a close. And so we think it's timely to make this change now. Frank will be returning to Houston to resume as president of Exxon Shipping Company. And Frank, on behalf of the Exxon management, we want to express our sincere thanks for a job well done in most difficult circumstances. And to Otto, we want to express the backing of Exxon management, which commits its full worldwide resources to helping Otto get his job done here in Alaska. Frank may want to make a few comments to you and Otto as well. Frank, would you like to say something?
I mentioned this was my 18th press conference. I think I'm just about talked out. But I want to thank all of you for the sort of treatment. I understand the concerns and anxiety and the interest worldwide, and we have certainly done our best to respond to your questions. Thank you.
Otto, would you like to say a few words?
Thank you, Ulysses. I just want to say that I'm glad to be here in Alaska. I'm sorry it's under these circumstances. I want to assure you that we're going to run the best possible cleanup operation. I've been impressed just in the few days that I've been here at the level of cooperation that's gone on between the federal, state, and local bodies, and I think that's a good base for us to build on.
All right.
Thank you. Okay, if there are no questions about that, we will announce the next press conference as soon as we figure out when it's going to be. Thank you.
And so this press conference at the Valdez Civic Center concludes with the passing of the baton. At a press conference not long ago, Frank Irasi made the statement that Exxon was leasing him a house for 6 months, but we just now have found out that Frank Irasi will be going back to Houston as head of Exxon Shipping, there's a new gentleman who's been introduced to us here today, Otto Harrison, who has been named manager of this response operation. Evidently, there was one more question for Don Cornett. He's now answering.
The claims, I would describe the claims handling as what's reasonable and what's right, and that is our intention. Thank you very much.
All right. Apparently, there was one final question about the claims operation. Well, day 15, press conference 18 for Frank Irasi. I think it's about press conference 44, 45, I forget, for KCHU and the APRN. We did hear about that there would be some change in spokesmanship. Don Cornett indicating that any questions as to what happened and why regarding the grounding of the supertanker Exxon Valdez would be handled by the chairman of the board of Exxon. An indication or a clue, I guess, to the local press that such questions will no longer be answered by Exxon representatives here in Valdez. Also, a brief indication that there would be a movement of the mammal, or an additional mammal recovery center established in Seward, and possibly a bird recovery center in Seward also. Don Cornett indicated that a letter had been sent to ASME, which is the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, and to one of the state more tourism groups, I suspect the ABA, that Exxon is concerned about Prince William Sound's future in both tourism and fisheries, and that Exxon will help fund any programs to rehabilitate the images of those industries in Prince William Sound. The claims office was announced as being up and running, and we were told that Exxon teams had visited Homer, Seward, Kodiak, Kenai, and let people know what is happening and what steps can be taken to prevent the movement of oil in those directions. We heard from Suzanne Stopey, who's the Exxon spokesperson for the Bird and Mammal Recovery Centers. 166 birds have been recovered, 4 released, 60 have died, 85 otters have been received, 42 have died. The new center in Groton Harrison, the old elementary school, the new community college here in Valdez is up and running. There'll be a press tour of that later today. There was a fair amount of back and forth from the press. Evidently, there are some 28 boats that have been involved in bringing back birds, animals, live animals, dead animals for recovery. And evidently, the Fish and Wildlife Service has forbade those craft to recover live otters. And there is a lot of suspicion on the press that this is due more to the inability of the shore installations to handle the incoming animals than on the part of the inability or lack of safety in the part of picking these animals up. At one point, press questions became so heated, Don Cornett stepped in and said that according to Cornett, the National Wildlife Fish and Wildlife Service would prefer to do a good job with a few otters than a poor job with all the otters they can bring in. No clear answer to all the controversial points regarding that statement or that question, but it was batted about a fair amount. Frank Arasi spoke mentioning that the good news is that the four critical areas are holding. A couple of those areas are far, one area, Esther Island, is far to the northwest of the sound and evidently has not been really in the direct course of the oil that has been moving. Two other areas have been protected, and of course the main battle being waged in the Sawmill Bay area. We did hear a litany of numbers. The number is not explaining how many of the people in boats and skimmers that are in the sound are being used or coordinated effectively, but there are almost 1,000 people and so many thousand tons of equipment, et cetera, et cetera. We also hear about 32 additional skimmers still being on the way to Alaska. Well, this is day 15, and there evidently are still skimmers being located and brought to this direction. Not a lot of new information or changes or shifts in today's press conference, except for the again the passing of the baton that was announced at the very end of the conference. A lot of the questions having to do with Exxon's response to President Bush's announcement this morning that there would be increased federal assets put at the disposal of the cleanup operation. Questions to Frank Arasi and Don Cornett about who is going to be in charge, who is going to coordinate the federal troops. Questions being raised that if our federal forces or agents or troops going to be used in place of workers who have been or might possibly be hired from the local labor pool. No clear answers, and oftentimes the question themselves, based on speculation, as no one really knows, seems to know just what George Bush's announcement actually entails for this cleanup effort. Finally, the most significant change or significant information transferred at this briefing was at the very end, Ulysses LaGrange, who was introduced as a senior VP of Exxon USA, made a statement that they were forming a specific office to handle this response operation. Otto Harrison was introduced. He has evidently an extensive international background working for Exxon. Has been recently seen quite a bit of service in Alaska, has expertise in offshore operations, logistics, and Exxon has brought him in to head this operation. Frank Arasi, we're told, is going back to Houston to run Exxon Shipping. One can speculate perhaps that with the headquarters people moving back to Houston and with mammal recovery and bird recovery being moved, perhaps at least discussed, to be moved to Seward as well as Valdez. That may also serve to to relieve this concentration of press that has been very evident in Valdez for the past 15 days. That about wraps up the press conference for today. We have no notice of any other briefings at this time. We understand that DEC will be doing some daily briefings of some type. If we're able, we'll try to get you at least information on those. There are no other conferences by the Coast Guard or other of the regulatory agencies scheduled at this time. The Exxon folks announced that their next briefing will be announced when it is scheduled. We don't have any advance notice on that, but we will broadcast that when that is announced. I want to thank KCHU volunteer and also Talkeetna Community Radio volunteer Trish King for her assistance in these broadcasts, APRN technician Chris Badalek, and engineering back at KCHU Studios is James Winchester. I'm Dave Hammack. This has been a live broadcast from the Valdez Civic Center Auditorium, and this is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.